This morning in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking a bit about severe weather and the kind of severe weather particularly that we have at this time of the year, where we're talking about things like thunderstorms and tornadoes and lightning and hail and that sort of thing. Every once in a while here on this program, we have our own in-house meteorologist, Ed Kieser, on the show to talk a little bit about those sorts of things. And that's what we're going to do this time around, and yet with a different set of guests, two guests, in fact, both of them from the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois, Donna Charlevoy and Glenn Romine. Donna teaches courses on general meteorology and severe weather, as well as the societal impacts of weather and climate. She's also the co-author of a university textbook on severe weather. Glenn is a member of the Convective Modeling Research Group and is a storm chaser, has done that both as a hobby and occasionally as a profession, and also has participated in several field research projects investigating severe weather phenomena. Also recently contributed to a NOVA program on tornadoes. And we're pleased they could both be here and talk a little bit with us here this morning. And as is always the case on the program, the idea is people who are listening can ask questions. And if you have weather questions, you can call us, and I know that they will do their best to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for the local folks here, but we also do have a toll-free line. That means if it would be long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I know enough to understand that if you have a big air mass that's warm and moist, and then if you have another air mass over here that's cold and dry and you slam those two things together, you're going to have storms. I know that much. But how exactly that happens, that I don't know. Is it possible to explain in really simple terms how it is that thunderstorms happen, why they happen?
Well, there is. There's actually, I like to think of severe weather as sort of, if you want to make it, you need to have a recipe, like if you're going to cook. And in order to make thunderstorms, you need three things in your recipe. You need to have some moisture. And of course, in the summertime, it's usually very moist. You need to have a way to lift the moist air up, which is usually a front, like you talked about. And then the other thing that you need is an unstable atmosphere, so that once you lift the air up, it kind of stays up there. And when those three things are in place, it's possible to get a thunderstorm. Now, that would just be your garden variety thunderstorm. If you add a fourth ingredient, which is what we term wind shear, that will actually get the storms to potentially become severe.
Okay.
And so that's usually when we're looking at if storms are going to develop, we look for those three or four things.
Well, now I have to ask you to define that. Wind shear. What is wind shear?
That's when the wind speed or wind direction changes as you go away from the Earth's surface. So if you have really...
So you get higher up.
Yeah. So if you have slow winds at the surface and then faster winds up above, that would be wind shear. Mm-hmm. Or if they change direction.
Mm-hmm. And anything you want to add to that?
No, I think she pretty well covered.
Okay. Well, we can talk about this a little bit more. I'm telling you that we have a caller, and rather than make them wait while I ask goofy questions, we'll give them the chance to ask the question. Here we'll go to a caller in Indiana, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Two questions. Number one, I guess generally is the statistical question, because I've heard different meteorologists on TV and the radio say two different things. I live near Lafayette, Indiana, and so they give the weather report for that area, and oftentimes you hear that chance for rain is 30%. And I've heard that it means that in the Lafayette area, 30% will have rain, or that where I am, you know, living, there's a 30% chance for rain, which is two entirely different things. And the second question deals with modeling. Just what goes wrong with the modeling? Is there a particular parameter, variable, that is the ones you usually guess wrong, or what? And I guess just up front, the first thing that I think of is the second week from, like, today, when they give the what the weather is going to be, whether higher or lower precipitation, things like that. I keep track of that, and you know, I sort of given up on it because it just jumps around everywhere. You can go from one day and the next day be entirely different. You know, instead of above temperatures, you have below temperatures, less rain, and the day before it was above temperatures with more rain. I just wondered what kind of inputs, cause that change and which things you're guessing wrong. Thanks.
Okay. Well, you want to talk about that?
Okay. Well, actually, I think I'll address the first question and let Glenn deal with
it. He can take the hard one.
Okay, well, good. He's a modeler, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the 30% probability of precipitation is very confusing, or the percentage probability. What that actually means is that for the forecast area, wherever the forecast is being issued for, there is a 30% chance that rain will occur somewhere in that area. So it's not for a specific point. It's not that it's going to rain 30% of the day. And so I think that for meteorologists, it's kind of the norm, what we usually give for a forecast. But the general public typically doesn't understand that even in that forecast area, if it rains somewhere that's not where you're at, that's still a valid forecast and it was actually accurate. Mm-hmm.
So if we said, for example, we're talking about we have a 30% chance of rain in Champaign County today. Mm-hmm. If it rains anywhere in Champaign County, we scored a hit. That
right.
doesn't necessarily mean that at my house it's going to rain.
Right. That's a verified forecast.
Okay.
Right.
And I guess, as the caller says, it is something that really confuses people, is that's just the closest you can't really pinpoint. You can't say, is it going to rain at my house, or is it going to rain in the northern part of the county as opposed to the southern part of the county?
Right, right. And that's actually a couple of years ago I was talking to the Illinois Pilots Association, and they were saying, you know, well, there's why can't you tell me where the thunderstorms are going to be so I know where to fly? Which, you know, that's really not possible. And that actually sort of leads into the caller's second question about the modeling.
About modeling, particularly as you get further and further out from today. Today we can say pretty with a fair level of confidence. Then tomorrow, well, it's not quite as good. And then next week, it's not quite as good. And I suppose there are people who would claim they could tell you what's going to happen 2 weeks from now. And there, the accuracy of your forecast gets less and less. So why is it that's so tough? And what happens that predictions end up breaking down over these long time frames?
Well, prediction through numerical models is pretty challenging. There's a lot of different scales of motion that occur within the atmosphere, and some of those affect the larger scale weather patterns that maybe we can see things that are going to happen over a long-term period, but most people are concerned about what the day-to-day weather is going to be like, and those are kind of noise within those larger scale patterns. And then we can look at those medium-sized patterns, and then there's smaller scale features within those as well. So there's lots of different scales of motions that are undergoing, and we try to describe those in numerical models using sets of equations that describe those motions. But it's a difficult problem to solve because we have to simultaneously solve a number of equations at the same time, and there's no perfect way to solve those. And so there's errors just in being able to solve those numerical problems. As well, we have to try to resolve features that are going on that are smaller than our model grids are able to resolve. And so processes such as turbulence and precipitation events like individual thunderstorm cells, on certain models, those are not actually explicitly solved. And so we actually have to make an estimate as to how those will impact the larger scale atmosphere. And so as soon as errors start to arrive in that forecast, then downstream of that, things get progressively worse in time. And so a small error grows into a big error in the long term. And so it makes long term prediction almost impossible when you get out to the really long time periods. It's a very difficult problem, but we are making steady progress and advances. Current 7-day forecasts are about as accurate as a 3-day forecast used to be just about 10 years ago. And so, but it is a very difficult problem.
And has that accuracy come because of computers and the ability to make models and put in all kinds of different variables and then have them crunch all that and come up with something on the other end?
Right. We've advanced our models of the atmosphere considerably over time. And we've also been able to get much better computing power. And that computing power allows us to get to resolve more and more of those smaller features that we earlier had to really kind of guess as to what was going on there.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this question, and I don't know if there's a ready answer. But say, suppose that we're doing a forecast for central Illinois. You know, a pretty good chunk of the state that includes us. If I ask how many different variables are there that enter into making the weather here? I mean, if we just said, okay, we're going to make a model, we're going to try to figure out what's going to happen here in the central part of the state within the next couple of days. How many different things do you have to put into that mix to get a model that's complicated enough and close to a reflection of the real world so that you could get a forecast with some fair level of confidence that it would pan out?
Well, I guess in terms of the actual data that you need, mm-hmm. you need to have the math that Glennon talked about. Mm-hmm. But you can make a really complicated computer model with math and physics, but if you don't tell the model what the current conditions are like, it's not going to be able to forecast, you know, in the future. So just to start off with, you need, you know, lots of standard variables like pressure and temperature, moisture, wind direction, wind speed, cloud cover. Soil moisture content is important, snow cover, what kind of terrain you've got, in some cases what kind of topography. And ideally, you want to have all that data in a pretty, what we call a kind of a tight grid. We collect the data kind of, and if you divide everything up in grids, you'd want to have it at like discrete points. And obviously, we don't collect weather data. We collect it that way. We collect it wherever there's cities, wherever we have information. So we don't have kind of a lot of initial data to begin with, but we do need all those variables that I mentioned, not just at the surface, but then at many points above the surface, because really it's what's happening above the surface that drives the surface weather conditions. So we'd need to gather all that data and then put it into our computer model, which would then have all the math and physics in it, and then we would run that. And the way we get the upper air data is by releasing Raywinsons, the weather balloons. Mm-hmm. And those are done by the National Weather Service. The launch site closest to us here is in Lincoln, and those are only done twice a day, currently at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., primarily because of cost. It's very expensive to launch them. Somebody has to go out, and you've got the actual instrument package and the balloon. And, you know, I think there's one in Davenport, southeastern Wisconsin. So they're kind of spread apart. So you don't really have a lot of data to begin with. So it's very difficult to make small regional forecasts, partially because of the initial conditions.
Yeah. So if somebody asks you the question, well, how can you get me a more accurate weather forecast? You'd say, well, you have to give me more data. The more data you give me, the more of this kind of information you could give me, then the more accurate a forecast I could make for you.
Correct. Yeah, there's lots of different tools that are being developed nowadays to try to actually take more advantage of what limited observations that we do have of the atmosphere to start our models off in a better guess of the initial state. But those efforts are mostly remote sensing methods nowadays because we simply don't have very many actual observing methods for in the middle of the atmosphere. So, But there are quite a few actually that exist for helping us with that problem, but it's a large amount of data that we have to consolidate into developing a picture of the initial state of the atmosphere, and it's inherently going to have some error. We'll never be able to have a perfect initial state for the model, and so we'll never be able to make an exact forecast for a specific location out to very, very long time periods. So the farther out you want to go in time, the less specific the forecast can be.
Mm-hmm. Do the models take into consideration what happened in the past? That is, you know, looking at say last summer. You know, we go back a year and you look at the various factors that influence the weather, and then look at what happened. Does that have any kind of predictive value about what's going to happen in the future? To say, well, okay, we had this barometric pressure and these winds and this humidity and all these kinds of things in the past, and we saw these weather conditions follow. Do you take that and put that in the mix too?
For the actual numerical modeling, there's not a lot of that's done. But that's actually something that's actually a method of forecasting and something that is done to look at usually on longer term forecasts. Well, in the past when we had conditions like this, you know, X happened afterwards. And so if we have those conditions again, we could expect that we might get X again. But from an explicit standpoint, usually it's on a shorter time scale.
Yeah. Well, let me introduce again our two guests for this part of Focus 580, Donna Charlevoix and Glenn Romine. They're both from the Department of Atmospheric Sciences here at University of Illinois. Donna teaches courses on general meteorology and severe weather. Glenn's a member of the Convective Modeling Research Group. He has also done some storm chasing. And we're talking a little bit about weather and how it works, particularly the kind of weather that we have at this time of the year, thunderstorms and tornadoes and so forth. And if you have questions, give us a call, 333-333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Here's someone calling from over near Danville in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
This has something to do with basically semantics, I guess. Okay, dawn is at a particular time, like 5:55 this morning or something. Now, is there a difference between dawn and daybreak? As in, I mean, is daybreak the same as dawn? Or because about, you know, 10 or 15 minutes before dawn, you can still see. You can see enough to work outside.
Right. Yeah, I'm not, quite honestly, I don't know the technical definition of those, but I think what you're referring to is the period of time when there's actually light, but before sunrise or
right.
after sunset, and that's referred to as twilight. So it may also be referred to as dawn or dusk. But yeah, there's a period of a couple of minutes before the sun rises where some of the light actually kind of bends around the earth, and
sure.
and we can actually see.
Sure, there's no real difference between daybreak and dawn.
I don't think so. No.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's just been bugging me for half a year or so.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Well, thanks for the call.
All right, thanks kindly.
As far as when we quote those statistics, I mean, the figure that we give it here, they give it on television, is for sunrise, sunset. And I'm assuming that there is a very clear definition of what exactly that means.
Right. That's when the actual visible portion of the sun rises, which actually it's a little bit below the horizon because of the refraction of the atmosphere. We can see the sun actually before it's actually even with the horizon because it bends the light around the earth. But technically, as soon as the sun becomes at 0 degrees to the horizon, that it's sunrise or sunset.
Okay. So some of these other terms we might use that mean different things to different people, but as far as meteorologists and people like that are concerned, everybody is going to agree on what is sunrise and what is sunset. That's why it is we can say at this time to the minute it's going to be this way today and it's going to be this way tomorrow and it's going to be this way the next day.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
We have a caller in Arthur next, line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I have a question about the different models as far as the European model and whatever we use for North America. What is it that I've heard the European is can be more accurate than our own? Is that because of population density and they're getting more data into that system? Or just I'd like you to speak to the difference between those. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, the model that the caller is referring to is abbreviated ECMWF. It's kind of the governmental acronym. There's actually many different computer models that are used to simulate weather conditions. And there is the European model, which is it's referred to. There's an aviation model. There's a model called the ADA. There's a handful of them. And the European model is actually run for for North America. So we're not inputting any different data into it. We basically collect all the data from across the country, and then we put it into each of the different models and then run the models. And so the differences between the models have to do with the way that they're set up in the computer program, the way that they solve the equations, like Glenn alluded to before, some of the assumptions that are made. And different models will actually do a better job under different conditions. And meteorologists that are at the National Weather Service that do a lot of day-to-day forecasting kind of know, well, this model's good for, you know, looking at winter precipitation, but this model doesn't do very well with thunderstorms in the summer. So.
And that's just based on looking at the previous track record of how good those models did. They make this prediction. Then you see what actually happened.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And the caller is correct that the in general, the European Center model is better at long-range forecasting than our models, and the exact reason for that is not entirely agreed upon, not surprisingly. But the European Center does use a much better method of starting their model off to begin the forecast. They use a very high-end, it's called data assimilation system, but that's very sophisticated and is believed to give them a better starting point. But they're completely different models, and so as far as exactly how they deal with some of the physics issues that are associated with model forecasting. And so the results are sometimes quite different.
Mm-hmm. This, again, this might be too complicated a question to give an easy answer to. But in the wintertime, when we talk about winter storms, it seems that with a winter storm, you can have days of notice. You can be a long time before the storm arrives. You can say with a fair level of accuracy that we're going to have a winter storm and it's going to take this track and it could bring a lot of snow and it's going to be very cold and so forth. And it seems that in the spring and in the summer, it's much more difficult to make those kinds of predictions. And the Storm Prediction Center lays out these very large areas and says within this, and it can be big pieces of entire states. We're saying, well, within this area, we think that there is a possibility of storms. And then, as we all know, it can be, you know, you can be going along and nothing really seems to be happening. And then suddenly a storm can come up like that. And it can be very surprising. What's really the big difference between what's happening in the wintertime and the summer that we can have this long time, this long lead time with a winter storm, but with a, say, a severe thunderstorm could pop up very quickly without much warning?
Yeah, that has to do primarily with the size of the storms. Mm-hmm. If you think about, like, if you look at the weather map, a weather map in the wintertime, these storms are big areas of low pressure with very, very large cloud areas, cloud shields, that extend hundreds, you know, 1,000, sometimes 1,500 miles. It could cover, like, half the United States. Whereas the storms that we typically think about in the summer, the thunderstorms, are much smaller scale. So they cover a much smaller area, and that's actually directly related to kind of how well we can forecast them and how far in advance. And it goes back to that issue of modeling and putting all that data on grid points. You can imagine if you put a grid over Illinois, and where the points where they all intersected, that's where the model is going to calculate conditions of the atmosphere. So you can imagine, I don't know, a typical grid. Maybe there's a point in Champaign. One up near Pontiac, you know, so maybe 50 miles or something square. Well, you could have a thunderstorm inside that square. Mm-hmm. And the computer model's only going to be really kind of calculating what's happening at those grid points. Whereas if you think about a winter storm that covers thousands of miles, now you've included lots and lots of those grid points. So you've got lots of data. So it's actually able to get a much better picture of what's going on. The other factor is that those storms tend to last a much longer period of time, several days. You get a winter storm that, you know, creates snow in Colorado and then tracks all the way across the U.S. over a period of 5 days, whereas thunderstorms last about 5 hours. And so the time scale becomes a factor as well.
Okay, very good. We're already at our midpoint here. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our guests, Donna Charlevoix and Glenn Rollmine from the Department of Atmospheric Sciences here at University of Illinois. By the way, we had someone call in and said, for people who are just curious, that the U.S. Naval Observatory website has all of the information you could ever want about sunrise and sunset. So if you're interested and you have internet access, you can go there, and I'm sure that it would be easy to find. The next caller we have here to talk with, someone in Rantoul, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was just kind of curious. They were talking about upper atmosphere observations. Why, or is it maybe not possible to use aircraft? You know, we have so many commercial aircraft flying at different altitudes. Can they receive data from a commercial aircraft, you know, put sensor pack on or something like that?
Yeah, actually they do. There is part of the system. I mentioned just the weather balloons because that's our primary method and that most people are familiar with. But there's actually another system. It's the acronym is ACARS, Aeronautical Something. But
system, probably.
Right. But basically, they have instrumentation on commercial aircraft. And, of course, the aircraft have regular flight patterns. And you can actually go online, and if you do a search for ACARS, A-C-A-R-S, you can probably find a recent map that shows all the flight paths. And so they tend to get a lot of information for takeoff, landing, and then also cruising altitude. And that information is made available to some forecasters, primarily, I believe, with the National Weather Service. So they do utilize that. That system actually has other information in it. It's a in conjunction with the FAA and NOAA, they work together. So they collect other information besides weather data.
All right. Hey, I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go on here. And I think the next person in line is in Bloomington, Indiana, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Could I ask about the severe weather warnings which interrupt television broadcasts? Do you know anything about the policies of those warnings? I mean, they interrupt the broadcast with a signal, which is quite unpleasant, and they sound the signal 3 times. Why not make a very pleasant sound and only sound it once?
I'm sure a lot of people agree with you. I think that the reason that they use the unpleasant sound is of course, it gets your attention, and they want people to pay attention. I'm not sure what the standard is behind doing it 3 times.
And then they sound it 3 times again when they're going off the air. I mean, after they've already given us the warning, why do they have to sound that very unpleasant sound 3 times more? Could that policy be changed? Why not give us a pleasant signal and only sound it once?
Well, I kind of think what Donna says is right. I think someone has decided that it has to be really irritating to get your attention, and they do want to get your attention particularly. I mean, if we were talking about something like a tornado warning, if it's one of those things where we're trying to say to people, there is a tornado and it's coming down your street, so take cover right now. I think the idea is that you want to get people's attention.
Yeah.
But whether there is, I honestly don't know if the FCC has set some policy or that there is some sort of policy that all stations do follow in how it is they do that. I honestly don't. I mean, we have a weather policy here, for example, at WILL that our own meteorologist has developed. But whether there's some kind of overall policy, you know, I don't know. Do you know, Glenn?
From having lived in different parts of the country, it seems to be more a choice of local stations and how they choose to broadcast the information. I would envision a situation where they might not have their on-air meteorologist available to disseminate the information, particularly during hours that are like late at night. Where they simply may not have someone there, and so they may have an automated system to make sure that the information still gets out to the public when they don't have someone who can present the information to you. As far as why they give the alert tones at both the beginning and the end of the message, I can't honestly say where that decision came from, but I'm sure it's associated with just trying to make sure that they have your attention during that time period and you know there's an important message between those tone alerts.
May I ask, in general guidelines, how severe does a thunderstorm have to be before you will interrupt a broadcast?
Well, there's actually specific criteria that make a thunderstorm severe. When they actually interrupt the broadcast to let you know that there is severe weather or when there's the potential for severe weather, because sometimes they're able to let you know, we think that these thunderstorms are going to become severe. And again, I'm not sure who sets the policy for individual stations to do that. But once a thunderstorm has either hail that's larger than 3/4 of an inch in diameter, it has a tornado, or it has caused wind damage or has wind gusts over 58 miles an hour, those 3 criteria, if it has any one of those 3, it's considered severe.
And it would be the people in the path of the thunderstorm who would need the warning. I mean, if you're in the thunderstorm, you know it.
Right.
You don't have to be warned, but it's the people who are downwind who are in the path of a thunderstorm who need to be warned, isn't it?
Correct. That is correct. And actually, with the technology that we have now that is used by the National Weather Service, they actually have automated systems that can look at how strong the storm is, what direction it's going, and how fast it's moving, and it will project out. The storm is expected to be near Champaign at this time, St. Joseph at this time, Danville at this time, and that's all done automated by the computer so that they do let the people that are in the path of the storm know.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And then for us, for example, for a broadcast station, they're not making this decision about the weather. If a warning is issued, the Weather Service issues the warning. Right. So if they say if they issue a warning for a severe thunderstorm or for a tornado, we get it on our news wires, and then we're going to go on the air with it. If there is a warning and it's for the air, like here at WWOW, well, we said within this geographic area, if there are warnings, we're going to give them, and we're going to give them as soon as we possibly can. And they do the Weather Service also. And I think this is only for tornado warnings, and I apologize, I don't remember for severe thunderstorm warnings. But they also, when they put the warning out, they request you to give that, you know, whatever it is you use that's the thing that gets people's attention. They actually request you to do that, to use your emergency notification thing.
Sure.
And as we were talking earlier, I think that is the basic idea. They want to make sure that they get your attention, and that you hear that, and that if indeed you're in the path of the storm, you know, you go to the basement or wherever it is that's the safe place for you to go.
Right. And, you know, since we're on this topic, I just want to kind of let people know that one of the best things that they can do is purchase a NOAA weather radio. Because if you don't happen to have the radio on or have the television on and you won't hear those broadcasts, if you have a NOAA weather radio, which you can get at Radio Shack or many different places, it will automatically sound an alert when there is severe weather in your area. And they're advanced enough now that you can actually program it for specifically your county. So if you're in Champaign County, it will only sound an alert when there's a severe thunderstorm warning or tornado warning for Champaign.
And I know that I assume that sometimes people are irritated by these warnings if it doesn't affect them,
right,
if they're not particularly affected. And I guess all we would say is that, well, keep in mind that somebody is affected. And when we give warnings like that or other stations give them, what we're trying to do is to help people out with potentially very important information. So, you know, if you can kind of deal with it, and if it's not for you, you know, be patient and know that we're trying to help somebody else someplace else.
Right.
Let's talk with some other folks. Bloomington, Illinois is next, line 4.
Yes, I had a question about weather forecasting and politics. I wondered if listening to the experts that Bignet Business and the Bush administration dig up, you know, to say there is no global warming, if that's sort of the equivalent of listening to the supposed scientists who say smoking is not injurious to your health. I think it's pretty accepted, isn't it, among weather people that there is global warming? That was my question. Thank you.
Okay.
I would agree that most scientists are in agreement that global warming is occurring. That's pretty well agreed upon. It's what's causing that global warming that seems to be where most of the debate surrounds. There's clear evidence that carbon dioxide levels have increased in the atmosphere. That's pretty hard to refute. But what impact that is having on the actual global temperatures is where people are arguing. There's a great deal of politics involved in these type of issues. And it turns out that there are scientists on both sides of the fence. And so if you want to find someone who will agree with you that global warming is not important, there are people who will do that. And not necessarily they're doing it in a dishonest way, but through their own research, they've convinced themselves that that is the issue. There are others who are on the other side of the fence and believe that, well, there's clear evidence that our contribution to the atmosphere has caused considerable global warming. And then there's the issue of, well, we try to predict what maybe impacts these are going to have in the future, and we're concerned about increases in severe weather events, and we're concerned about changes in precipitation and temperature patterns, and we have made attempts to try to forecast what those might look like, but there's a lot of differences in what those people have decided the future might look like. And so it leaves a lot of open doors for policymakers in trying to make decisions because they're getting a lot of conflicting information. And it's unfortunate that we can't present them with a more clear picture of what we think is going to happen.
So you don't see it as the equivalent of the tobacco supposed scientists who went around saying tobacco is okay. You don't see it as that clear cut.
I do not believe that there are any scientists who are really trying to work for the power industry or the, you know, people who are producers of large amounts of global warming gases. I doubt that they are hiring people who are providing them with favorable outlooks, because I don't know that those people would have a great deal of credibility. Mm-hmm. If you come from industry, it'll be very difficult for people to assume that you have an unbiased opinion. But there are plenty of people just within the academic world who are still on both sides of the fences, and they don't necessarily have a reason to be biased towards one side or the other.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
All right. You know, one of the criticisms that's often made of media and how we cover issues like this is that we're taught to find balancing opinions. So if we go on and we interview somebody who says global warming is real and it's because of human activity and I think it's going to get worse, then what you're supposed to do is go out and find another guy who says, well, I don't really think that that's true. And, you know, there are long-time cycles in the climate, and we really don't know that it's going to get worse. It could turn around. The criticism that's made is that then that in the mind of the listener, that leaves the idea that 50% of the scientists think one thing and 50% think the other thing, which says, well, the scientific community is, it's a toss-up and they really don't know. If you ask the question, okay, suppose we get a representative sample of 100 scientists, are 50 of them going to say one thing and 50 the other? Or is there a prevailing, you know, view on the question that well, more is going to be on one side or more going to be on the other side?
Well, I'm not a climate scientist, so I can't speak for them. But my experience with those that I do know is that it would not be a 50-50 split. The vast majority are of the opinion that we are causing global warming. The extent of that global warming impact is not agreed upon among them. Hmm. So the IPCC is probably the authoritative national agreement for global warming, and their opinions about what the global warming impact is going to be changes every time they come out with a new report. But in general, it's always predictive of warming conditions. The amount of warming over a time period is not entirely agreed upon. But and what impacts that will actually have on local communities such as Illinois, if you're concerned about what it'll have perhaps on the farming or agricultural industry within Illinois 100 years from now, that's a very difficult problem to try to guess with the tools that we have available to us today.
Yeah, I suppose if we're having a hard time saying what the weather's going to be like 2 weeks from now, what it's going to be like 100 years from now is
right.
Even that much more difficult.
Right.
Exactly.
Our guests here this morning are both from the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at University of Illinois, Donna Charlevoix and Glenn Romine. Donna teaches courses on general meteorology and also severe weather, as well as societal impacts of weather and climate. She's the co-author of a university textbook on severe weather. Glenn's member of the Convective Modeling Research Group, has done storm chasing and involved in different kinds of research projects investigating severe weather. And as I mentioned beginning of the program, he recently contributed to a NOVA program dealing with tornadoes. That was called Hunt for the Super Twister. If you have questions about weather and how it works, that's what we started out talking about here this morning. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next is a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to get back to the warning issue and the tones that they transmit. I believe that those tones they transmit at the beginning and end of the warnings are not only alert tones, but they also contain a subaudible tone that actually turns on your weather radio if it's in the standby mode, and probably also does the same over the cable systems. And if you happen to have a same encoded radio, which is the one that you can program down to the county, you don't hear the tones when it comes on. You hear the alert, but when the broadcast is finished, you hear the first tone, and that actually turns off your radio, and then they finish up. But I believe they transmit those tones at the beginning and end to enable the alert, and then to turn it off after it's over with. So, in addition to getting your attention.
Oh, okay. Very good.
Just wanted to throw that in there.
All right. Thanks for the information. We appreciate that. Let's go on to somebody else. This caller is in Atlanta, Illinois. Line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting program, particularly on the European versus the American models. That was interesting. Otherwise, my call was to say exactly what the person before me said, that that tone was probably to turn the NOAA radio weather radios on. So I'll just hang up now, and sorry to bother you.
All right. No, that's fine. No bother at all. Okay, well, let's go to another caller. This will be Urbana, I believe, line number three. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I would like to thank WILL for their update continually, and especially at night. And, you know, I don't want to know necessarily what's going on in Champaign-Urbana. You know, I might want to know about Ford and Iroquois, because that may be the weather that's coming toward us. So I just want to put in a plug. Thank you, WILL, for continually breaking in and telling us the weather.
Well, okay. I'm glad that somebody finds it useful, because very. I'm sure that some people find it irritating. You know, I guess we're trying to strike a balance between interrupting the programming and also then providing information that we think is important.
Right. I appreciate the information.
All right. Well, very
thank
good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. Where are we going next? Danville, line one. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
One real quick question for you, and I'll hang up and listen to the answer. But I was wondering, it just seems like in the last few years that the weather forecasting has become a little more inaccurate, and I just wondered if that did have anything to do with global warming and the models changing, you know, in their calculations. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, that sort of presupposes that the weather forecasting has become less accurate in the last few years. I would expect you'd want to say otherwise.
Remember the forecasting we've talked about. Models in forecasting and their ability to forecast situations, but of course a person makes a forecast and they use that model information as part of their forecast. A good forecaster also uses current observational trends, their knowledge of how models behave in certain situations, and so the full forecast problem, it involves more than just whether the model is good or bad. So for a specific location, if you feel the forecasts have been better or worse, that it may have a number of possible reasons for that. But unfortunately, I couldn't quote on the statistics for your particular location as to whether they've been better or worse, and I don't know what your source of weather information is. If it's from the National Weather Service or if it's from a local media, most meteorologists make their own forecasts, or at least try to make their own forecasts. And that will necessarily almost always require that they be different. And so you may see a lot of disagreement between different forecasts, but a lot of them are using the same information and they may not necessarily read it in the same way. But individual skill in forecasting, it takes a lot of practice and a lot of time put into it to become a good forecaster. And so I guess my answer is that I don't know why.
Well, I just go back to something that you said earlier, did I hear this right, that one of the things we can say is that now the 7-day forecast is now as accurate as – we're as good at 7 days as we used to be at 3 days. So when you go 7 days out, we're pretty good. There was a time when we could really only go about 3 days out with that kind of confidence, but now we can go a whole week out with that kind of confidence.
Right. The models are getting progressively better with time. When you go out into that kind of time frame, it's very difficult to look at observational trends and make an estimate of what the weather is going to be like in the long term. So you become increasingly dependent on model forecasts as you go farther out. Of course, those model forecasts are progressively worse as time goes out as well. He also mentioned that I think he was concerned about maybe whether global warming would have an impact on the local weather. And that you have to think of global warming as being a much, much larger scale, slow change in patterns. And so to look at day-to-day weather and compare it to global warming, they're really very different phenomenon. Global warming might have changed the mean temperature 0.1 degrees. And so the impact that maybe has on local weather is going to be quite small. But in the long term, there could be changes in the overall weather patterns. But those won't be as noticeable on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think, you know, the last 2 months, really, in central Illinois, we've been below normal for temperatures. You know, and there's, I always run into somebody who says, well, there's no global warming because it's been very cool this summer. And you can't extrapolate to such small time scales because global warming that they're talking about is, you know, over the period of hundreds of years. So looking at a couple of months or even over a period of 5 years, the global warming signal, if you will, isn't going to show up. So.
Okay. Well, we got one more caller at least here, line number two. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a more basic question. I would like to know how the wind blows. Basically, what causes the pressure to change?
Fabulous question.
That's pretty
actually,
basic.
Well, you know, actually, when I teach the basic weather classes at the university, this is the one thing that I always tell students that they have to know when they leave, because it's something that's kind of fundamental. The pressure changes is what causes the wind to blow. You basically, if you think of a weather map, you've got high pressure and low pressure, and the air always blows from high towards lower pressure. And you can think of this sort of analogously, if you had a kind of a column of air, there's lots of air molecules in it. The air molecules have mass and weight, and so they exert a force on the Earth's surface. And the atmosphere is always trying to get into equilibrium. Mother Nature likes to be in equilibrium, and so it tries to get rid of those pressure differences, and it pushes air towards the lower pressure. The reason for those pressure differences actually has to do with differences in temperature. And when we have differences in temperature, that actually causes differences in pressure. You can think of the ideal gas law back from science. And those temperature differences are actually caused by the uneven heating of the Earth's surface by the sun, because we live on a sphere. So there's more heating near the equator and less heating near the poles. So you get these temperature differences, which then can generate pressure differences, which then generate wind. That's kind of the big picture of it.
Okay.
Does that answer the question for you?
Yes. Thanks.
Okay. Great.
Very good. And was there anything else that you wanted to add on to that?
No, I think that.
Okay. Well, let's very good. We'll go on to line number one and another Urbana caller. Hello.
Yeah. Thanks for having the program, and thanks for that preview to that previous caller for asking their question, because he reminded me of something I've been wondering about. As the sun goes over the Earth, effectively, it's always heating the ground directly below it. So whatever part of the Earth that it's you know noon, that part of the Earth is getting warmed, and then the air above the ground gets warmed up. And my understanding is that that's what creates a lot of the westerly breezes. Is basically if it's afternoon a few hundred miles east of here, then the air is being warmed up and it's rising, and so since the air rises to the east of here, that creates a vacuum that sucks all the air from where we are, sucks it in a west from toward the east, So I'm wondering, is that how it works? Because I know usually the wind is from the west, so I'm just wondering is that what usually makes the westerly breeze?
Okay, well, actually, both of the things that you're saying are correct, but I'm not sure to what extent they're related. You're absolutely correct in that the sun doesn't actually heat up the air directly; it heats up the ground, and then the ground transfers heat to the air, and that creates. Vertical motions. That's why we see a lot of clouds in the middle of the afternoon, because you get a lot of rising air. The issue of the westerlies, why the winds tend to blow from the west in middle latitudes, that has to do with the general circulation patterns. And in middle latitudes where we live, we typically have a west-to-east wind flow pattern, primarily due to the general pressure pattern that you find across the globe. And you tend to have a lot more higher pressure regions, kind of around what they call semi-permanent high pressure near roughly 30 degrees latitude. And you get semi-permanent low pressure systems that tend to form around 60 degrees latitude. And so then you get a force that goes from essentially south to north. So you would think, well, the wind will blow towards the north. But because we're on this rotating Earth, there's something called the Coriolis effect, which turns winds to the right in the northern hemisphere. So instead of going from south to north, it actually turns to the east. So it gives us kind of our westerly wind flow pattern. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Glenn.
I would just add that oftentimes we almost always see this sort of westerly wind pattern in the atmosphere as an average. But as the afternoon goes on, when we start heating at the surface, it forms little thermal bubbles near the ground, and those thermal bubbles rise up into the atmosphere, and we can sometimes see those as cumulus clouds when they rise high enough that they form clouds. But as we heat the surface more and more during the course of the day, those thermal bubbles tend to rise higher and higher up in the atmosphere, and the wind speeds tend to be higher as you go up higher in the atmosphere. And while we see these thermals going up, there's also air that has to sink back down to the surface. And those sinking air masses coming back to the surface tend to bring gusts of wind with them. So you'll often notice on the gustiest time of day is often during the late afternoon, and that's when these thermals are rising very high up or higher up into the atmosphere and then sinking back down, bringing some of that higher wind speed momentum from aloft back to the ground.
Okay. Well, I hope that answers the question, because we're going to have to stop. We've used the time for this time around. And we want to say thanks very much to Donna Charlevoix and Glenn Rollmind from the Department of Atmospheric Sciences here at the University of Illinois for being here and talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And we appreciate it.